Greetings from K9 to diddly-dum, diddly-dum, diddly-dum. End of message.
Faithful listeners, and welcome to episode 127 of the Diddly Dum podcast, the fourth best Doctor Who podcast out there. I'm Doc.
I'm Hayden.
And I'm Mark.
Lovely little sniff in there, Mark. Just a hint of what's to come.
Yeah, sorry, I'm a little bit under the weather.
Mark is currently in an oxygen tent because he's got a cold. And it's to keep coronavirus off the rest of the two of us.
Yes, I've self-isolated myself in the depths of the museum.
Right, has anything interesting been happening of late? I can tell you that I found out that I appeal to be reminded of the idea that someone sent us on social media as a better rhyme for Diddly Dum.
Oh, yes.
In our Diddly Dum song was actually from friend of the show, Mark Cockrum, the human palindrome, who reminded me that his original suggestion was Diddly Dum Weakling Scum, which is both amusing and accurate.
How apt. How apt of Mark there. I have to say... I have to say I was listening earlier to the latest episode of Nerdology.
I was about to say the same thing.
Oh, really? Were you?
Yeah.
Oh, and I... Really, I mean, I've said this to him before, but the last time he had the wonderful Ian Martin on with him, and it was just those two, they did an episode about the Target books, the reprints of a year or two ago.
Oh, yes, that's right, yes.
Not the reprints, sorry, I meant the new ones, like Twice Upon a Time and Day of the Doctor and that thing. And hearing them again on their latest episode, it really reminded me that, you know, Mark's voice is like the Horlicks, Ian Martin's voice is like the comfort blanket. And the podcast is like a roaring fire, and all I have to do is get my dressing gown and slippers on and recline into the sofa and listen to them.
You mean get into your bath chair, get your ear trumpet out.
Get into my... and ask Jeeves to take any calls and not disturb me for an hour.
That's why Mark and Ian, of course, are our great rivals, being the Horlicks aficionados. Well, of course, here at the Diddly Dum Hooseum, we are the...
Cigarettes and alcohol.
We are the Ovaltinies, happy girls and boys.
Do you know what? I had one of those Ovaltinies in the back of my cab once.
Seriously?
I've had them all in my cab.
Yeah, genuinely. A lovely elderly lady got in my cab and we were chatting throughout the journey. She's very chatty and lovely and she said, do you remember the Ovaltinies at all? I said, the Ovaltinies? What? I said, were those little girls who used to sing about Ovaltine on the old adverts? I think I've seen clips of that. And she said, yes. She said, that was me. I was one of the Ovaltinies. And then she sung the entire advert for me in the back of the car. It's quite wonderful.
At least you thought it was wonderful until she got out and you realised that was meant as your tip.
Yeah.
I used to, I was told a story back when I was younger and I never really got it because obviously it was way before my time, this. But apparently my great-grandmother, she was friends with the model who was in the Nimble Bread advert. She flies like a bird in the sky.
Sky.
Yeah.
She flies like a bird. Oh, me, oh, my, I see her fly.
His sinuses have just blocked again.
She flies.
Real bread, but lighter. Make it part of your calorie-controlled diet.
No, and she used to work, I think she worked in a flower shop somewhere in Warwickshire. This is the great-great-grandmother who had the Doctor Who, the Return of the Time Lord, inlay for that that she gave to me in 1996.
Right.
Tenacious Doctor Who link there, but I just thought I'd better link it to an old advert again.
My dad was an Ovaltini, apparently, in his youth.
Oh, really?
Oh, before we go any further, I was a little nonplussed by Hayden's little squeak of surprise there. But I think you see, I see where he's coming from. For the fecklessly young among you, the Ovaltinis was a children's club founded in, I think, 1935. Obviously promoted by Ovaltine, which was and is a sort of malt-based milk drink. And before you leap to scorn, I understand that by the outbreak of the Second World War, it apparently had about 5 million members, this club. Which is quite something. I think you'd get the usual stuff for kit for fan clubs. You get a membership badge, a booklet, secret codes, that sort of thing. The club was probably most famous, as we've mentioned, for having its own radio show on Radio Luxembourg in the 30s. Which was, I think, either called Ovaltini's Concert Party or the League of Ovaltinis. With its theme song, We Are the Ovaltinis, sung by a group of very well-spoken children. So I think Hayden's confusion here stems from the Ovaltinis being used more broadly for members of this club across the country, and more specifically for the group of children doing the singing. So while Mark's taxi fare had presumably been one of the singers, when I said that my dad was an Ovaltini, I meant that he's only someone who had a membership badge. I mean, do you really think, if it had been the other way around, that I'd have waited 6 years to crowbar a reference into it, to it into the podcast?
I've seen a little bit of Doctor Who news, and it's making me fret a little. That, and I really hope, Mark, that this time around you have definitely pre-ordered the Season 12 box set, haven't you?
Yeah, I have, with Amazon.
Brilliant. I have heard on the grapevine tonight that apparently the pre-order numbers are completely full up now. Yeah. So basically, they've taken the Blu-ray off pre-order again.
Yeah,
because they're not printing anymore. Yeah.
I'm wondering if there's a whole bunch of people who are blocked buying multiple copies this time around again. Well, because...
Oh, not again.
You know, it was selling for such ridiculous sums last time around. Perhaps they're hoping that it'll do it again.
Absolutely. Well, the McCoy one's completely sold out now as well, so... I honestly would hate to see you miss out again, so...
Yes.
Yeah, well, I pre-ordered that one before I pre-ordered the Season 14 one. Although I want both. I was more worried that Season 12 would just disappear again, and it looks like it is, so...
Talking of books, which we weren't, have we got any to plug at the moment?
Oh, well, it's very kind of you to mention that, my dear Doc Whom.
What a coincidence! I can't believe it!
Oh, my dear, oh dear. I'll slip you a fiver later. Yes, indeed, yeah. In fact, my horror novella, The Lurking, is up for pre-order. It's coming out on the 3rd of August, but you can pre-order it now from Amazon, you can pre-order it from Waterstones, from Barnes & Noble, all your good bookstores all around the globe. The book's all about a man who is sort of struggling to keep things going with his girlfriend. He's a little bit of a disaster. And then one night when he has an accident, he is stranded in a field and takes shelter in an old abandoned aircraft hangar. And when he gets there, he realises he's trapped and that he isn't alone. And that is, that's my new book. So yeah, please keep an eye out for it. And links in the show notes.
You may have seen, faithless listeners, in fact, by the time this goes out, it will be well underway, that we have finally put out the official call for votes for our forthcoming Christopher Eccleston era retrospective. We'll be asking people to vote for... It's much, much easier than previous eras, because there's only one season to go by. I think only the Paul McGann era will be less of on tenterhooks to find out what the winner is. And we're asking people for their top five stories. And you can vote by, we'll be keeping an eye on any of all of our various presences on social media. You can either go to us on Twitter at diddly_dumb or on Facebook at diddlydumbpodcast. Or you can email us at diddlydumbpodcast@yahoo.co.uk or any other way you'd like to get in touch with us. We've already had quite a few votes.
That's three two-parters as well, isn't it? Is that
yes.
right?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
And we're counting the two-parters as one single story, yes?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the Slitheen one, the Gasmasked Child one, and the finale are both considered a single story. So there's only 10 stories. So get voting. We shall be putting out several reminders in the coming weeks, and we won't be doing it until after at least a couple of podcasts in the future, because we've got to finish Series 12 yet.
Christopher Eccleston's been all over social media lately, almost to the point where I, after reading about 200 tweets in about an hour about him, I ended up having to mute his name because it's all my timeline was full of. After he appeared at the Galley One convention in LA.
Yes, I had no idea he was going there. That's quite a surprise to me.
Mm. He looked like he had a marvellous time. He seemed very happy.
Being interviewed on stage by Radio Free Canada, I suppose you can't have everything.
Yeah, I haven't seen it myself yet, because I was busy at the weekend my wife's birthday. But I saw a couple of, a bit like Mark, I saw quite a lot there. And I thought that might actually be a very good time to actually start the voting off, as it were, whilst the name Christopher Eccleston was trending on Twitter. Mm. So,
Oh, he's not daft, is he?
Nope. No, well, I am, but... You know.
Anything else we want to talk about?
Just one thing. I've recently been, I'm actually going through this quite slowly, been taking my time with the Season 26 box set recently, and I've seen Battlefield. I haven't seen... They've got multiple versions of Battlefield and The Curse of Fenric, which I haven't got around to watching yet, but decided to put on Ghostlight yesterday, and thought to myself, oh, this is really strange. It's quite dark, this. I wonder if there's a setting on my television which I need to alter to make it a bit brighter. Turned it on, I thought, this is still quite dark. Anyway, I watched a little bit more, and then the scenes in that sort of the basement ship when Ace is being attacked by that giant larvae thing. As you can tell, I was paying very close attention to the story. I thought, I can't see a thing here. Very odd. I took my sunglasses off and I thought, nope, still very dark. So I went back to the DVD. And even though the picture quality wasn't as good, and it was actually fairly grainy on the DVD, DVD was a lot brighter than the Blu-ray. So I was wondering if there's anyone out there listening to this who has seen Ghostlight yet on the Blu-ray version, whether they've had the same problem as well, because I'm wondering if we've got another faulty disc thing going on with this. With the very dark. I know it's a dark story anyway.
Oh, not another one.
Yeah. What, not another dark story or not another
no.
faulty
Sorry,
Blu-ray?
I was doing Brenda from wherever it was when asked about elections.
Oh, yeah. Oh, not another one?
Yeah.
General election.
You're joking. Not another one? Oh, for God's sake, I can't stand this. There's too much politics going on at the moment. Why does she need to do it?
Yeah, I was quite surprised by it. But let us know if you've noticed anything like that as well. Apart from that, I finally got around to listening to Russell T. Davies' episode of Desert Island Discs today.
Oh, right, yes.
At work. And it was a lovely... I mean, a lot of the music went over my head, I have to admit. But considering he's obviously had quite a lot of tragedy that he's had to contend with recently, obviously the death of his husband, I thought he was a very positive, very jovial, very vibrant interview from him. And he was obviously very, talked about Doctor Who quite a bit in there, didn't he? And said, you know, it was, sometimes he still feels like he's still quite tired from his experience of working on it and Torchwood and the Sarah Jane Adventures. And I'm sure you've all listened to it now, but yeah, I mean, give it a go. It's brilliant.
Right. Can you hear me? Episode...
It's Doc. Sorry, what? Doc?
Oh, how amusing.
Hello, Doc? It's like no one else has tried that one on a podcast recently.
There goes another rib. Can you hear me? Episode 7 of Series 12, written by Charlene James and Chris Chibnall. Directed by Emma Sullivan. Oh, hang on. Was this the one you were messaging us earlier today, Mark, to say, oh, dear?
Yeah, I messaged you earlier on today because it's funny, I watched it the first time round with the Kelly family.
Oh, all right.
And enjoyed the creepiness of it. Picked up on a few of the mental health bits. It's strange sort of sitting there watching it with other people and watching the kids being scared and stuff. So it kind of distracts me slightly from my own viewing of it. Which is fine because I know that I come back to rewatch it to gather my thoughts for the podcast. And like I said, I enjoyed the creepy story. I felt it sort of wrapped up a bit too quick. And then the bit with Yaz at the end, I just started looking at my watch and stuff and thinking, this is dragging on a bit, isn't it? Why is this going on so long? And, you know, my mind wandered and stuff. And then the episode finished. And I thought, oh, right, okay, that's fine. And then I read afterwards on social media that the whole thing with Yaz, which is never specifically stated in the story, but apparently, I think the BBC pointed this out, was that Yaz had been considering suicide in the flashbacks, which isn't, like I say, it's not explicitly stated in the script. And possibly if I'd been paying more attention, I might have picked up on it, but I didn't feel... But then again, I've seen lots of other people saying that they didn't pick up on it the first time round. It's only really... afterwards, because I thought it was just Yaz running away from home.
Well, so did I. I had no idea that she'd been contemplated suicide.
No, it just seemed to me, I mean, everything fitted with her just kind of running away from home. And that, so the anniversary meal was her deciding not to run away from home and coming back home. I didn't realise that it had gone quite so deep and dark as actually this was about contemplating suicide. And I have to say that knowing that, it made the rewatch quite gruelling, to be honest, because I think on the rewatch I was paying a lot more attention to the mental health issues as well. I mean, I'd say I've had experience to varying degrees of almost all the, you know, either myself or somebody else, almost all of the issues that were raised by this episode. I mean, I thought they were done very well. They were done in conjunction with the charity Mind, weren't they?
Yes.
I saw a statement from Mind about that, and they said that they'd actually sat down with the script writers and the actors, and they'd had people who actually suffer from the problems and themes that are covered in the story. They had them on board as well. So they had a huge group thing, you know, so of people discussing how best to...
represent these...
how best to represent these and what's sort of okay to say and what isn't okay to say and what sort of language should be used. So I thought that was really good. But it did, like I say, it sort of, having known all that, it kind of really focused my attention on a lot of the mental health issues. And it just became a really... honestly, I don't think I'm likely to watch this episode again because it covers so much stuff that I've sort of had fairly close experience of.
Yeah.
I mean, it is all quite beautifully done. I mean, the bit with Thibaut turning Ryan away at the door, because I know about that, a friend of mine who was isolated, and I remember friends going around there and him just sticking his head out the window and telling them to go away and leave him alone, and he wouldn't open the door, and he became very ill. And he, sadly, he was suicidal as well. Luckily, fortunately, he survived it. But it's, it brought a lot of stuff back. I mean, I think it's good to have an episode like this. I think it helps. It probably helps people to try to hopefully encourage people to find help. But it's that thing of, I don't want to use the word triggers, but it kind of stirs up old memories and feelings that you've sort of... I thought I'd laid to rest and stuff, and they sort of in a way it was a bit like sitting down with a counsellor, you know, and having a counselling session and stuff coming up that you've maybe not thought about for a few years or something, and I found it quite unsettling.
I've got to say I had a similar response to that, not with this episode, but I watched a programme, I think it was was it Jessica Jones?
Oh.
I can't remember now.
Possibly.
Yeah, and I watched Jessica Jones, and there was a character in that who was abusing drugs. And I knew someone, I had a friend in my teens who had a very troubled past. and was the one who dabbled most and the one who took the most, you know, and it was a really unsettling experience. And I ended up, when watching this Jessica Jones episode, and I can't remember the people's name. I'm really bad with people's names and shows. But he ended up becoming a heroin addict through the David Tennant's Kilgrave character. Was sort of
the guy who lived in the same hallway as Jessica Jones? Yeah.
And I found that unsettling to watch to the point that even though I liked the show, I think he got cleaned up by the end of the first season. It was. Just things like that. Things like that and things like self-harm, if they are displayed in a program, I find them quite difficult to watch because I have had experience of people around me, unfortunately, dealing with that. And it does alter your perspective of the program. I mean, I've suffered with mental health problems in the past, mainly brought about by bereavement and depression being a big point of it. And I think this episode, those elements of Can You Hear Me, I think were very sensitively represented.
Yeah.
Which elements?
So I thought Yaz's story was quite sensitively portrayed. And it wasn't complete. I mean, as we've said, it wasn't explicit that she was going to kill herself. It was just that she was at a point of crisis. A crisis doesn't have to necessarily mean that you take that ultimate step. That final step, it can mean you run away and you never go back home, or you start drinking, or crisis points act as different triggers to things. I really enjoyed how they portrayed her, and I actually felt quite touched at the end when she went back to the policewoman who gave her the 50p. I quite liked that. I thought that was very well.
Yeah.
Although I thought the Tebow scenes were really nicely put as well. I wasn't sure whether he was talking to his family at the end or if he was at a self-help group, but it showed that talking therapies and cognitive behavioural therapy sessions are a very effective way of getting through problems.
Yeah, well, it is that thing of talking to people, isn't it? It certainly helps.
And you'll be aware, listeners, that via the battery of aerials and dishes on the roof of the Hoosium, and via our several satellites in orbit, we monitor all Doctor Who podcasts. And from what we're aware of so far, Mark, if Yaz was contemplating suicide, whoever said that on social media is probably the only person in the country who is aware of it.
But
I've not heard anyone else know that she was. It was all about running away, as far as I and anyone else I know.
Yeah, that was what it seemed to be, yeah.
No, I don't know, because I think watching it the second time round, I think there's definitely hints there. That's the thing. Like Hayden said, it was a crisis point, and I think it could have gone either way.
Oh, dear. Well, I mean, so you two have have experienced these sort of issues yourself to a greater extent than I have. And given that it's touched you and you've recognised, or that you've identified things that you recognise in the episode, I'm reluctant really now to say much about what
was. You should have gone first. Then we could have embarrassed you after the fact.
I just thought, well, I wasn't particularly impressed, really. But then I think the problem's becoming that they will have to have a new TARDIS team before I can even begin to look forward to watching Doctor Who again. And I'm not saying that necessarily means including Jodie has to leave, but I would say I think Ryan and Yaz certainly have to leave, because it's getting to the point with me where how bad I consider them to be is just distracting me from enjoying the show. I mean, I'll tell you what I thought of the show, and this is entirely my opinion. It's no comment at all on what you thought of it. But I was rewatching it yesterday, actually, and I realised that I've reached the point now where I'm watching Doctor Who solely for the podcast, Yeah, partly because I expect that one day, as always, the show will become watchable again. And if that happens, I don't want to miss any backstory by boycotting it now.
Mm.
But mostly, it's only really the fact that we're doing it on the podcast that encourages me to watch it. So it's more the fact I enjoy talking to you two than the fact I enjoy watching the show. Because I just thought, Can You Hear Me was... I just thought it was pretty mediocre. And that's me... that's me removing several words from what I was intending to say.
Can I just say, just because of what I've said regarding the mental health stuff, doesn't mean that there aren't other issues that I have with the show. So please don't feel...
I mean, yes, there are a lot of just general bits and pieces of it which took me up. But I also thought... Well, to be honest, let's get into it.
Yeah, go on.
And I'll try to moderate what I'm going to say.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, my overall thoughts of it was that it wasn't the strongest of the season. And I have thoroughly enjoyed this series so far. I mean, we've only got two episodes left and... Oh, hang on, that's a bit of a spoiler for what I'm going to say about the next one. It's been a huge improvement on Series 11 because where you are now, Doc, is where I was. I reckon probably around about the time of It Takes You Away last year, where I really was thinking, I'm just watching this now because of the podcast. I'm watching it because...
Yes, I remember you saying that, yes.
There's a space on my shelf, and I wasn't connecting with the characters. I didn't feel like I had enough connection with this era of the show. But it's come back for me through episodes like Fugitive of the Jadoon and Spyfall. I mean, actually, do you know, I've enjoyed all of them apart from... I'm not speaking about, obviously, The Haunting of Villa Diodati, because we'll speak about that next. But up to this point, I've enjoyed all of them, and I've enjoyed elements of all of them. Apart from possibly Orphan 55, which I think I'm starting to dislike more and more as this season goes on. There were faults with this, definitely. I mean, I wasn't entirely certain about the scene at the end. I wasn't sure about Zelin. I wasn't sure about Rakaya. Is it Rakaya? Is the other god, isn't she?
Rahaya. Rahaya, I think. If you can't pronounce that, just call her Storm from X-Men.
Okay, yeah. Okay, so Storm from X-Men and Zelin. I quite liked their concept, but I didn't like the way that they were dispatched, let's say. I don't think there'd be an almighty being that would dispatch them that easily. And it was typical. It reminded me of Power of Three, you know, good setup, but then a very disposable ending to that villain. I did think that. But there were elements of this I enjoyed, and I liked the sensitivity of the subject matter and the way that they dealt with it. The last scene apart, I'm afraid, but it was middling. But it's middling in an enjoyable season for me. I just think you're right, Doc. I mean, you've probably only got a couple of episodes left until that team does break up, so it's not long.
Mm.
And then I think the elements are in place now for this. I know, obviously, exposition is still a big problem with it, but I think those elements are in place for a much stronger season 13. I certainly know that my hopes for season 13 are a lot more than what my hopes for season 12 were. So, you know, I mean, we'll just have to see.
I mean, it's not all bad. I mean, imagine how much more disappointed I'd be if I'd realised that Yaz had contemplated suicide and not gone ahead with it.
Oh,
yes, I know. I have to say, regarding the exposition, there was one moment of exposition that was actually done beautifully in this episode, for once.
Oh, yes.
When they did that lovely bit of Watership Down style animation.
Oh, yeah, yes, cool, yes.
Yeah, that was nice.
Mm.
This will shock you that I've never actually seen Watership Down or read it, so...
That's probably why you're so well adjusted. You didn't go through the trauma of seeing it as a child.
But then, it was only last year that I saw The Lion King for the first time.
Oh,
so wow. I'm sure all the Fester sisters are nodding and thinking, oh, that's why you're so completely out of touch with everyone else in the country.
But also the other thing I wanted to say was regarding Hayden's point about it being sort of seeming to be wrapped up too quickly. I was talking to my friend's very smart 10-year-old boy, and even he said to me...
This is Elliot.
This is my friend's son, Elliot, the timeless child.
Yeah.
he said that he felt this story should have been a two-parter because it suddenly seemed to stop very quickly, and he said he didn't find the ending very satisfying. And I thought that was very perceptive of him, because that's exactly what I felt as well, that it seemed to be barreling along, and then suddenly that kind of... I mean, I can understand that the girl's conquered her fear so she can control the, what's it called, Chigaska, which is another one of those...
Falling asleep on the keyboard jobs.
Well, yeah, another one of those Chibnalls. Yeah, he always seems to hit the letter K, doesn't he? I think he just randomly types in letters and then makes sure that at least one of them's K and it's fine. But yeah, that ending was just too...
Hampered by runtime, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. It was just like, oh, we need to get through this quickly, so here we are. And also the doctor is escaping. Oh, another thing, Elliot wasn't sure why she could suddenly move her sonic screwdriver with what appeared to be the power of her mind. And this was another thing I didn't realise, because this is something else that I saw on social media afterwards. Apparently it's because the cuffs were magnetic. But there was nothing in the plot that stated that the cuffs were magnetic. So I just sat there watching it, watched the sonic screwdriver fly out of her pocket into her hand. And I just thought, what? That's ridiculous.
Well, you could have just had a line that said, "Of course, my magnetic cuffs."
Yeah,
or something like that. Yeah,
because it just looked stupid, like she was using the force or something.
Yeah. Oh, of course, my Deus Ex Machina cuffs.
Yeah.
I think the difference between us here might be that you're close enough to some of the issues they were handling that you could see those straight on. I'm perhaps so further away from them, and therefore I'm being blocked from engaging with them by just this TARDIS team, which I can't handle. I mean, the saving grace of the series, although I think it's still not enough to save it, is the visuals. That aerial view of the city of Aleppo is extraordinarily good. But the visuals are supposed to be extras for Doctor Who. It's supposed to be, you know, an added additional plus, not the be-all and end-all. Because here we have a great-looking model of Aleppo in 1380, but absolutely no reason why we should be there.
No.
Unless this is just to allow the Doctor to say a line.
This must be one of the oldest hospitals in the world. Of course, Islamic physicians were known for the enlightened way they treated people with mental health problems.
A line which she delivers dreadfully. Well, then, who speaks like that? As she does most lines these days when she's speaking to herself. I don't think Jodie does talking to herself well at all. Which, considering how much practice she gets, is surprising. But it's far too self-referential, which I'll get on to. And so my problem here was, as soon as they said that, of course, Islamic physicians were known for blah, blah, blah. I thought, oh, Lord, we're in for a lecture this episode. Which may have put me on my guard against any themes they're going to go into. Because I think there's this assumption in places like the BBC, and possibly, a stereotype, The Guardian, that we all need to be taught how enlightened Islamic society was historically. Well, I don't need to be taught that. I'm not ignorant. Also, I suspect that whatever demographic sorely needs enlightening about Islam isn't likely to be watching the BBC or reading The Guardian. On top of which, I do wonder if it ever occurs to them that telling us how enlightened Islam was 650 years ago is perilously close to saying, even if it isn't now. This will sound unusually smug even for me, but I flatter myself that while there are undoubted gaps in my knowledge of the world, they're not so gaping that I need lecturing on them by Chris Chibnall and his writing circle. If they're going to show us this, then do just that. Show us, don't tell us. I was watching the first few episodes of Call the Midwife last week, for want of anything better to do. And for anyone outside the UK, it's a BBC drama series about a posse of midwives in 1950s London, dashing around London, delivering babies. And it's quite painful how they keep hammering in plugs for the NHS. Now, I'm a passionate proponent of the NHS. That's proponent, not opponent. It's maybe because of that I resent cack-handed attempts to ram that message home. Oh, thank you for saving my baby's life, Doctor. Yes, well, Mrs. Jones, you can thank the National Health Service for that. 5 years ago, you'd have been left to die in agony. And I'm not joking, they say stuff like that. Mm. And you thought, who's this supposed to be hitting? Because even those who need educating about the NHS aren't going to respond to such obvious propaganda. Who's lecturing us on global warming? Nothing I have no problem with. But if anyone who does need educating on it, who's lecturing us on global warming this week? Chris Chibnall. Oh, really? I had no idea he was a climatologist. He isn't. Oh, really?
Yeah, but having said that, you know, Barry Letts wasn't an ecologist. I don't get that argument when people say that Doctor Who's all it does nowadays is talk about woke subjects. That's bollocks. That's what it's always done.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
I've just said a few minutes ago, show us, don't tell us.
Mm. Yeah.
It's perfectly fine for Chibnall or Barry Letts to push their points about whatever things they believe in.
Yeah.
But do that by showing us. Make the story you're showing us an allegory through which we experience that. Don't tell us. Because if you're telling us, then you think, if you're showing it to us, you're thinking, and it's done well, you might think, oh, what a fine scriptwriter, what a fine producer, a fine director. If you're lecturing us, then you're thinking, how does he know more about that than me?
Yeah, you see, I think this is a problem with modern-day television, full stop, is that they don't let the viewer find those allegories for themselves. They have to explicitly say it just in case they miss it.
Yeah.
It's talking down to the viewer. That's what it is.
I do think
absolutely.
Mental health was done in a very powerful, but perhaps more subtly, as in less on the nose, by World Enough and Time and the Doctor Falls, which, you know, Bill's conversion into a Cyberman and loss of self-identity and the things with the Master. I felt that worked really well. None of that was, as you say, none of that was told to you, was it? It was just shown. It was there in the dialogue. It wasn't. Whereas I do tend to think the messages and are quite good, but there does seem to be one specific one every week, doesn't there? And that's, I think, feels a little bit too forced. You know, because I mean, the episodes that I've enjoyed most probably I'd say were the Fugitive of the Jadoon and Nikola Tesla's Night of Terror, which
I like that.
And I don't think there wasn't any overt messaging,
in a way,
was there?
No.
Mark's resolved one of my issues, because if I was saying, "Oh, who are Charlene James and Chris Chibnall to lecture us on mental health?" Well, we found out later, don't we, that actually they were taking advice from Mind UK.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying it's a problem, because it's not something that I'm not saying, who's he to tell me that when I know that it's completely different? Mm. I'm just saying that I know that already.
Mm.
Who's he to patronise me on it? But then if it is being helped by Mind UK, then maybe I would learn something from it.
Mm.
But I think my problem is, if I'm going to be taught about anything by TV drama, even if it is done by showing rather than telling, I really need to be in the zone and engaged by the story.
Mm.
If I'm going to empathise with their issues, I really need to care about the characters. And I'm finding I cannot get past the crappy writing, acting and characterisation issues. I keep getting dragged out of any suspension of disbelief. For example, the oh-so-modern British accents in Aleppo in 1380. And I'm not saying they should be doing the Syrian equivalent of Patrick Troughton's Mexican accent, but perhaps verging slightly away from Estuarine would have been useful. Taylor tells us at one point something that is important.
You tell me creating happiness is important to my mental well-being.
I blame the TARDIS.
It's just like having a historical character say, okay. It just takes you out of the moment. You need to tie this translation circuits. Are they set to Estuarine?
Yeah, exactly.
It's true. But they've there was a line when
Tahira.
Now, I did have a problem when Tahira used the very modern phrase "my mental well-being." She says several lines in. I just thought a woman from Aleppo wouldn't say that.
No.
I have to soothe my mind. I have to, you know. Something like that instead, not, oh, my mental well-being. You know, all right, Jeff, how are you today? If actually, it's, The Blackadder, what's up with you today? Oh, what's up with you today? No, I don't know. What's up with me today? What's up with you today?
Now, the reason why Chaplin is so funny is because he's part of the Great British Music Hall tradition.
Oh, yes, the Great British Music Hall tradition. Two men with incredibly unconvincing Cockney accents going, what's up with you then? What's up with me then? Yeah, what's up with you then? I'll tell you what's up with me then. I'm right round off. That's what's up with me. Right round off. Yeah, like, get on with it!
That bit took me out a tiny bit, I have to say. But I still enjoyed it, but I just think the... Yeah, go on.
What was the bit that you were saying you didn't like, Hayden? Would that be the scene with Graham and the Doctor?
Yeah, and I'm and I'm not saying this because...
This has been the big issue, hasn't it, since?
It has. But it's... I haven't criticised Jodie Whittaker's acting.
Only because you haven't been able to get a word in edgewise from me doing it.
18, 19 episodes into her run so far, and I've never once said, oh, I don't think she's given that the full... Not full, well, full conviction, full range. I think she really let this down, but it's a troublesome scene to write anyway, because I just think of what other doctors would have done in this situation. And you would have got, I think with almost every single doctor, barring possibly, no, in fact, probably all of them, there would be a more of a conversation, and whether it would be, see, this is why I don't know why it would have been helpful, because people with mental health shouldn't be told to keep their chin up. Oh, chin up, you know, I think things will get better. Hasn't happened yet. That can't be helpful for some people who are suffering with mental health issues. But someone like Tom Baker may have said something like that. Other people, like John Pertwee, may have said something quite philosophical along, you know, something maybe along the lines of the, you know, courage isn't...
A Daisiest Daisy thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Being afraid isn't... Yeah. Oh, sorry, no, that's profound, isn't it? The fear is a superpower, that kind of thing. Yeah,
that's right,
That's far more reassuring. Just to say, I'm still a bit socially awkward, ain't I? Yeah, I'm just going to walk away, and then I'll think of something. Oh, she's turning to Brian Clough. I'm just going to walk away, and then I'm going to come back, and I'm going to think of something I should have said.
The thing is, Doc, I worry about getting sick again. Coming back, and I didn't know who to say it to, so I thought I'd say it to you. You know, seeing as you're a doctor. You know, because once you have it, it's with you the whole time. Not quite the shadow, but hey, don't get me wrong. I mean, my checkups, they're all fine, but it made me think. You know, and I thought I should talk about it. Because those nightmares, I mean... Well, they made me realise that the fear is still there. Yeah.
I should say a reassuring thing now, shouldn't I?
Yeah, probably.
I'm still quite socially awkward. So I'm just going to subtly walk towards the console and look at something. And then, in a minute... I'll think of something that I should have said that might have been helpful.
I disagree with you on that. I thought that scene, for me, I watched it the first time round and I found it quite warm. I mean, I found it very human, and perhaps that's the problem. People are saying that the doctor should be more than human.
Yes, yes.
But for
me, it
was also saying that even the doctor sometimes doesn't have the right thing, because you can't just... Somebody who's just said, I'm worried about my cancer coming back. I've had this conversation with my mum. And you can't say, oh, don't worry, it won't. You can't say... I think I saw somebody suggest she could have at least said, live every day like it's your last, Graham. I thought, that would have just scared the crap out of him, wouldn't it? Oh, what? What do you mean, Doc? You've been scanning me. But, you know, it's all right not to know. And the Doc, I actually found that scene quite warm.
Absolutely.
Because at the end of it, Graham does kind of cheeky, oh, well, huh, thanks for the chat, Doc. But then he's got a little smile on his face. He looks, I think, just having reached out to her and said that to her has helped him. Mm. The doctor said, well, I haven't got quite the right word. But she's done it in a way that I think's slightly got a bit of a... It's got a bit of comedy in it.
I agree
Perhaps
with you.
Perhaps that's badly judged, But I've seen people saying that she cold-shouldered him, that she rejected him.
No, I
didn't see any of those things.
I don't believe that. And I think that Graham's response saved the scene.
Yes,
actually.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah. I do think it saved the scene. I just didn't like the fact that... I think it was Jodie's choice of, you know, standing there cross-armed, and crossing your arms is an indication of two things with body language. It's looking after yourself. It's sort of protecting yourself, or it's a sign that you're not listening or you're not taking it in, and you want to be doing something else if you've got your arms crossed. You know, you're a little bit agitated, and that's not really what she was.
But if somebody's telling you something like that, you probably are agitated.
Not to the point you crossed, I don't know. I didn't think the conviction was very good.
For me, it just rang true. It didn't, perhaps it wasn't the, perhaps, I don't know what people, I think people wanted the doctor to be more reassuring or something, but she didn't have that, and she said she'd try and think of something. It just seemed... Like I said, it seemed very human to me, but perhaps that's not enough for some people. It seemed very real and genuine, and I think it showed that it's all right to not have the right words, but sometimes it's just good enough to listen.
Okay, I understand that, and I see where you're coming from there. I just wish that maybe there'd been another way of playing it from Jodie's side. That's all.
There should have been another way. The way I... So it was Graham seeking consolation from the doctor. And while he's talking to her, saying, I'm worried that my cancer's coming back, she's, like you say, folded down. She's peering at him.
This is
a curiosity. Now, they tried Socially Geeky with Matt Smith, and it works as comic relief when you're playing a game of football in the park. I don't think it works as the appropriate response to a man worrying about cancer. I mean, I was actually, when Graham was, and this is unlike me, when Graham was telling her about this, I was almost on the edge of my seat while Graham was saying that, because I was genuinely half expecting a really, really good moment from the doctor. That they had Graham saying this because they had a wonderful reply from the doctor. And what we get is, I should say something reassuring now, shouldn't I? See, Graham's in pain, and her response is to tell us... Her response... may well be to not have the words to console him, but she conveys that by telling us how lovably eccentric she is. I mean, the self-referential nature of I'm still quite socially awkward, so I'm going to subtly walk towards the console and look at something, and then that might have been helpful. To me, shows the doctor almost bizarrely behaving the way that men are stereotypically supposed to behave when women come to them with problems. I think we've all heard women complaining about this. A woman goes to a man with a problem, let's say a boyfriend or a partner, and he tries to make it all about him and not her. No, let's talk about me, not you. She's self-referential again. I'm talking to myself again. Look how eccentric I am. And isn't it interesting that for the second time in only a few weeks, the BBC has had to issue a press release to address fan issues in the series. The issue we decided to confront here is that it's a common experience for people to struggle to find appropriate things to say when someone comes to you with an issue like fears about cancer. And I've seen a number of people saying, yeah, that's so spot on. We too have experienced awkwardness in this sort of situation. Well, who hasn't? I mean, within the lifetime of this podcast, 6 years, in fact much shorter actually, each of the three of us has lost a parent to cancer. And as have some of those close to us in the Diddly Dum podcast, we've experienced what they're dramatising here. Now, of course it's difficult to find the perfect words to console someone who's suffering like Graham is. In fact, the perfect words probably don't exist, but it's not difficult to show kindness towards a friend. Instead, the Doctor plays it as a joke. And I don't think that Doctor Who should try to handle something as intimately personal to many of us as cancer by putting it in the hands of people who are still waiting to be endowed with personalities by the writers. I've seen it compared online to two things. Tom in Pyramids, just casually pushing aside Lawrence Scarman's, is it Lawrence?
Marcus.
Michael Sheard?
Oh, no, yeah, no, it is Lawrence, isn't it? Yeah, it's Lawrence.
Yeah, Lawrence Scarman's dead body, and saying, I did tell him he's a fool. And Sarah's saying to him, oh, you...
Strangled.
The mummies.
Not this time, there are marks. His late brother must have called.
That's horrible. You were so concerned about his brother.
Well, I told him not to be. I told him it was too late.
Oh, sometimes you don't seem...
Human.
And the other thing is Peter Capaldi with his cue cards. But even when Peter Capaldi needs Clara's cue cards to get past the, oh, I struggle to understand human emotions, you can tell he's doing it from a genuine desire to get over that, to be able to handle it, rather than just saying, oh, sorry, mate, I can't do anything for you. It just seemed a dud note for me. And I think, yeah, risking a dud note where what you're aiming for is something as important as handle mental health issues properly, then at least it's, you know, it's worth it. If you're risking a dud note when all you're going for is to make the point, can't it sometimes be awkward when someone comes to you with a problem and you don't know what to say? Seems a little... It just seems a little... I just wish they hadn't done it, really.
Well, I don't think... I think the point is not so much that it says, isn't it awful when it happens, it's that it's okay that you can't...
It's okay to be awkward.
Something.
But I would say not to say, oh, I can't think of something, therefore I'll say, sorry, I can't think of anything to say. You can't think of something, therefore you say something as if it effectively is a platitude.
No, I mean, we're obviously not going to agree on this, are we? Because I found the scene worked for me both times I watched it.
Yeah, but we're not supposed to. It's not. We're not trying to convince each other.
No.
I'm not. Point of view.
No, I know. I'm not. I'm just merely just rounding off.
Having said that, I thought that of the three of the companions who are having issues, Grace and Graham's is by far the more effective.
Yes.
And I don't think it's unconnected from the fact that Graham is the one that I have the least problem with, because I think his acting works. And Grace was quite good as well. And that could even be because we have actually seen the ground laid for their relationship right from day one in Jodie's first episode, haven't we? So it's not suddenly, oh, Thibault's agonising over Ryan's absence. I didn't realise that had happened. Yaz has been bullied and had problems and ran away from home.
Well, we knew that she'd been bullied before, because that was mentioned in Witchfinders, wasn't it? But it was just a quick bit of conversation. It's never been touched on. Basically, that episode had to do too much heavy lifting, I think, with the Yaz storyline. I think...
Yeah.
These could have been bits that have been seeded and put in elsewhere throughout other episodes. Another thing that Elliot said to me, in fact, was, why did they shove that bit on at the end when it felt like the main story needed more, and that bit could have been done elsewhere in previous stories?
If it had been done in previous stories, you could have maybe had a little more depth of it here, and it would have given a little more for Yaz to do in Series 11.
Yeah.
I'm completely behind you on that, yeah. I mean, I was pleased it was there, don't get me wrong. I thought it was a lovely... I say a lovely little scene. Actually, it was, like I said, it was dealt with very sensitively, and I thought it was well acted and actually a well written part of the story.
Turning aside from the issue, the story, what did we think of the whole? I thought the best thing in it was Ian Gelder's Zelen.
Yeah.
The male bad god.
That was incredibly enjoyable, but I did feel... I did wonder if they'd gone a bit too far with him, because I like the story being dark and spooky. The fingers flying off into people's ears is one of those oddities that will stick with people for a long time. Sticking people's heads for a long time. But there's that bit where he's... there's that girl, and her mum says, don't worry, there's no or there's no bogeyman or monsters or anything. And then she gets into bed, and then suddenly that bloke, this is a small girl. And a lot of kids are watching this the night before they go to bed for got school the next day. And it's going to be the last TV show they watch, and they're showing a small girl climbing into bed with some creepy old man staring at her and his fingers flying off towards her. It's just...
Oh.
It's going to give you... I just wondered if that was going a little bit too far.
Oh, I see what's happened here. Mark couldn't make it because he's unwell and Mary Whitehouse has replaced him. Mate, I mean, it's something which the show's always done, isn't it? I mean, it has always maybe pushed the envelope. I completely understand what you mean.
I just wonder, it's just because it's a child's bedroom and the kids who are watching it are probably about to go to bed. I'm not necessarily complaining. I'm kind of more positing the question, I guess.
Interesting,
isn't much different from the end of episode one of The Loch Ness Monster, where suddenly the Zygon looms at Sarah while she's on the payphone, and that's we just see a brief quick glimpse of it. Now, admittedly, that would have been about 3 hours earlier.
Yes, that would have.
In the night, on a Saturday,
I don't know, anyway.
I'll tell you what, Mark's talking as a true parent there. As the only parent of the podcast, you are definitely talking as the parent of the podcast.
Quite possibly. Yeah, and yeah, the fact that I did watch it with my friend who's a mum and her two small daughters.
Right. How did the Kelly girls react?
It was far too creepy for the youngest, who's about 4, I think. And the older one, Eve, who is 8, did keep clutching the cushion, but she didn't hide behind it because she said she wanted to watch what was going on. But she found it very scary, but said she really, really enjoyed it. So it's exactly the same as when we were kids. It's that enjoyable. Enjoyable being scared. It suddenly occurred to me, I was thinking to myself, this is quite a strange thing to put into the episode. It's quite a strange concept to have, isn't it? Your fingers flying off and sticking people's heads. And it suddenly realised, this is literally the antithesis of what this programme's about. This programme is about if you've got a problem, you talk to people.
Yes,
it's about communicating with people. And the baddie here, his fingers fly off and they go in people's ears. He puts fingers in people's ears, literally stopping communication. I wondered if that was what they thought when they invented him.
Maybe.
No, I think that's interesting, that, because I thought it was an unusual concept. Fingers in ears, I mean, that seems an unusual thought. So I wouldn't be surprised if that's the point of it.
Yeah, that's what I think. I felt a bit sorry for a guy who works in the design department, Ray Holman, who put out pictures on his timeline after the show of Zelin with his fingers floating in the air. And and people started writing underneath his post, Wet Willy. And he got ever so upset about it because he wasn't aware of this. Are either you familiar with a Wet Willy, so to speak?
No.
I am familiar with wet willies in school and
Could you explain, please?
Yeah, basically it's where you it's a playground thing or it, where you, it's like a kind of giving kids a wedgie or something, but instead you basically suck your finger and then you shove the moistened finger into your friend's ear and shout wet willy. I think that's about it, isn't it?
That's about the long and the short of it.
Is that about right, Hayden?
Yep.
And I think, unfortunately, Ray Holman thought people writing wet willy at him was some sort of insult. He nearly left Twitter. Bless him.
In my day, the equivalent of wet willy was get back, you never said may I, and British Bulldog.
Well, here we are.
I wish they put a bit more thought into, you know how Zelin traps the Doctor into freeing his mate?
Yes.
By using her instincts and prejudices against her. I wish she'd done that in reverse. You know, the bit like the old thing of trapping a genie in a bottle. I bet you're not powerful enough to make yourself so small to fit in this bottle. And then the genie says, oh yes, look. And so he throws in the bottle and you put the cork in and you've got him. It's like she just seems to wave a wand at him and traps two people who've just been told are gods, are, you know, immortal gods or powerful.
Yeah, the sonic screwdriver's being far too overused, isn't it, as just a... which has been something that's been a problem throughout Jodie's era, I think. And the fact that it's always got answers, she scans everything with it and stares at it. And...
Oh, should we give it a marks out of 10?
I'm going to give it 6.5, I think. Certainly in the lower echelons of Series 12, but I still enjoyed it, regardless of its faults, but it was slightly better than Orphan 55. 6.5.
I'd give it a 5.
I think I'd give it... It's difficult because I think it does some things well and I think it does some things crappily. But isn't Doctor Who ever
does.
This was
my conundrum.
I hate to copy Hayden, but I think I'm going to go with a 6.5 as well.
Yeah, trendsetter.
The Haunting of Villa Diodati.
Yes.
Writer Maxine Alderton. No co-writer credit for Chris Chibnall this time.
Hooray!
Director Emma Sullivan, who directed Can You Hear Me?
Can I start?
Go on then.
I loved it. I really, really enjoyed this. And I do wonder whether a little of that is due to the fact that over the weekend I was reading Susan Hill's novella, The Woman in Black. So I was already immersed in horror. But no, I thought this was a wonderful story. I really, really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed the performances. I enjoyed the narrative. I enjoyed the little beats that the companions had in it, like the moment when Ryan's getting throttled by the hand. He's like, yep, definitely a hand. You know, there was good comedic moments. I thought Graham was on top form. I thought Yaz had bits to do again. I thought the scene with the lone Cyberman finding the baby and the woman, that was pure horror, that. And even the moment when he snapped her neck.
Yeah. And you're not sure who he's killed, if he's killed the baby or the woman.
I thought, I could not quite believe that.
I was praying it would be Ryan.
He was just in there with them, just for...
Oh, Yaz, I'm not fussy.
No, and I enjoyed that era anyway, the Lord Byron. And is this the first time that we've had a celebrity son and daughter in the same series of Doctor Who?
Oh,
but in different episodes, with Ada Lovelace obviously being in Spyfall Part 2. And you had her father here, Lord Byron, in the first one. And I think it's even referred to by Jodie, isn't it?
Yes.
I love the callback to the loss of Bill and Adric at the hands of the Cybermen. I thought that was brilliant. I liked the dilemma that the Doctor had. I thought the Doctor was far more commanding in this one. Back to actually, probably, it's one of Jodie's stronger episodes, actually, I think, for her characterisation of the Doctor. There were, I really, really enjoyed it. I liked the look of the Cyberman. I liked the sound of the Cyberman, actually, as well. It felt a bit more intimidating than, so, we meet again, Doctor.
Oh, I love that Cyberman, though.
Of course you do, and it's a fantastic Cyberman, but I thought this was really creepy, this Cyberman here, and I liked Shelley, I liked, Mary Godwin, Lily Miller's performance too. I did think there was a moment in there when she seems to remember after about 5 minutes of, oh, hang on, I have a baby somewhere in this house. I have to find that baby. I thought that was a bit absent-minded. It was not very... that bit grated a little. As did the Doctor absorbing the Cybranium and then giving it up so easily, I thought. I thought we were getting prepared for a bit of a chase through space at the end. Or maybe that's where the two-parter was heading. But maybe that's just my headcanon coming into force straight away, and that might be what ruined that for me. No, I honestly really, really enjoyed this one. I thought it was great.
Here for we've been saying for nearly 2 years, if only Chibnall would try and be a bit more like Moffat, and he does it by having his one of his main characters forget that she's got a child.
Yeah, well, who'd have thought he would have taken that that inspiration from that little plot, yeah. Now, what did you two think?
Well, it's okay, really. This is the reason why I didn't mind having to tone down the ferocity of my remarks on the previous one. Because I knew I've always got this lot as a fallback. An episode of two halves for me, I'm afraid. Hinging on the moment of the reveal of the lone Cyberman. The first half gives us a group of four fools who can't act. visiting another group of four fools who mostly can act. Who thought that when the Doctor said, "I'm going to introduce you to some of the most enlightened minds of a generation, at the pinnacle, the absolute zenith of their creativity," it was just a cue for a piss take? I didn't find the ghost story that scary, and it's for the same reason I've already talked about. I don't really care about the people in it. And I can't see how we're supposed to feel scared of a ghost story where every scary scene is undercut by Byron trying to chat up the Doctor, quite creepily. I mean, Lord Byron is a fascinating, complex historical character. And he's a bit of a perv as well. But here he's reduced to one trope. He's just permanently horny. I just think, oh, please. I said at the end of Peter Capaldi's era that when we didn't yet know who was replacing him, that my fear about a female Doctor was that male writers would surround her with weak and stupid men in the hope that she would appear strong, if only by comparison. And it's bad enough when they do that to Ryan, but to Lord Byron? I mean, we've got plenty of female writers now, and even they're doing it. Either because Jodie's such a weak Doctor, or her acting is so below par. You're making Byron's every other line a corny flirtation with the Doctor, so she can easily keep putting him down, rather than actually have her be a strong enough character in her own right, not just by comparison, to deal with him on his own terms. You didn't have him hiding behind Miss Claremont. So it feeds her a line at the end where she can put him down for it. Oh, it just...
I quite liked him.
Oh, so did I. But it was the way he was presented that I thought was irritating.
Yeah, I think he was quite subtle in everything apart from said horniness.
Yeah.
I quite liked Polidori, who of course is the kid from Mr. Bean's Holiday. When it dawned on me who he was, I thought, oh my God, and I couldn't quite get that film out of my head. But I quite liked his sleepwalking through the walls. I found that was quite funny, and obviously an escape route out of their situation. I thought showing Percy Shelley his death was a very interesting concept, actually.
Yeah, not sure how she did it, but...
Yeah, this seems to be another thing that they've... Is this another new power that she's got? Because she also managed to... I know she can make contact with other Time Lords, but she also goes into... She just sort of goes into Shelley's mind to see...
Yeah, this isn't new, though, is it?
It's very Spock, isn't it?
This is what David Tennant did.
Yeah, what, Girl in the Fireplace?
Girl in the Fireplace and the Shakespeare Code as well.
Oh, right, okay.
Super hands in the asylum. He looks into his mind, doesn't he?
Right. Seems a bit of a cop-out to me, but, you know. Anyway.
Oh, completely. But it has precedent, unfortunately.
Right, okay.
I see the Doctor's talking to herself again. It's exposition.
Oh, recharging, not good. Figuring out how to manipulate the elements and creating an extremely sophisticated and probably unlimited external power source.
Another mediocre script for me. We get lines without motivation and lines without explanation. So, lines without motivation are here is where I think I'm on firmer ground. We've just had an episode which we've been told, and which you two believe, is in many ways a profound and sympathetic exploration of mental health, right?
Mm-hmm.
The very next episode... Yeah. In ways.
Yeah.
In the very next episode, Mary Shelley tells Ryan this.
What's his problem?
Oh, paid Dr. Polidori no heed. He's bad-tempered because he does not sleep. He walks at night. A terrible affliction. Imagine, never being able to truly rest.
Now, that's the only thing that Ryan knows about Polidori. But simply because he doesn't like the way he's been looking at him, Ryan starts sneering at him and trying to pick a fight.
Mrs. Shelley seems fatigued.
Only of waiting to dance.
You're the one who looks like death.
Do you insult my visage, sir?
Might want to stop shooting daggers and maybe take a nap, all right?
I beg your pardon?
He means perhaps you should take a rest.
I'm a physician. I'm in rude health.
Whatever you say, mate.
Now, how does that fit in with... If that line, he doesn't sleep, he can't sleep, he walks at night, a terrible affliction, imagine never being able to truly rest. Imagine if that line had been what was wrong with Thibault in the previous episode. We'd be expected to be sympathetic. Ryan starts acting like, I don't know. Can we deduce anything from this other than the fact that Ryan's a bit of a prick? I just don't think that Ryan's been presented very well at all. He's monosyllabic, which I suspect a lot of is just too many people in the TARDIS. They only got chance to give him half sentence here and there. Same with Yas. Well, admittedly, he doesn't make much of it. Lines without explanation.
This place keeps unfolding in on itself as well.
Exactly. I think we're caught in a security system. It's turned the house into a sort of giant panic room.
Where'd she get that from?
Yeah, that was a bit of a leap, wasn't it? And also Ryan being the one who suddenly says, it's like the house is folding in on itself, which doesn't seem like a sort of layman. I suppose he has been travelling with the doctor for a while now, but seemed an odd thing to say. And then she takes that enormous leap that, yes, it's just like a giant panic.
You said about this in the lab on the beach, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Ryan says something totally innocuous, and the doctor says, oh, and suddenly it's the key to everything.
Did you enjoy the line, need to take a squiz at your skeleton?
Was that another Lord Byron's chat-up?
No, that was a doctor to Lord Byron.
See, she was the one encouraging it.
Ooh. Yeah.
When Yas was sitting on the floor with Miss Claremont, and they're saying, Miss Claremont says,
you could try asking him.
I have. His answers only increase the enigma.
I know someone like that.
Mary reproaches me. Insists I should find a more reliable prospect. Not that she can talk.
Perhaps she's right. His eye does seem to wander.
This enigmatic person of yours, would you trade them for reliable and dull?
My person's a bit different. Did you see that?
Now, this seems to me clearly her just saying, oh yeah, I know someone who's quite enigmatic. It's hard to understand them. She's obviously just saying, oh, this is my friend, the doctor. You've seen how many people have seriously tried to interpret this as a sign that Yas is carrying a torch, either for the doctor or for Ryan.
Yeah, I don't quite believe that.
It's been quite funny. An episode of two halves, I'd say. On 26 minutes, the lone sideman appears and then proceeds to carry the show almost single-handedly, I think. Did either of you twig that the burning figure outside on the lake was the Cyberman before it was revealed?
I was spoiled. I was spoiled.
I knew there was a Cyberman arriving this story. It'd been all over social media, people going, oh yeah, there's definitely a Cyberman next week. I was absolutely certain there's a Cyberman next week. It's just, it did rather spoil it for me because I just went, oh, that'll be the Cyberman floating over the lake then.
I was spoilt because I saw the episode late, because I came to it a day late. I managed to miss it all on social media, all of these spoilers. I saw a picture of him on Twitter the day after, because I watched it on Monday morning. But it didn't ruin my enjoyment at all.
No, I don't think it wasn't the biggest surprise. Were you completely unspoiled then, Doc?
Yeah, I was in the County Palatine at the weekend. And so I missed it on Sunday night. I didn't watch it till I got back to the Hooseum on Monday night. And through the whole of that time in between, I couldn't go on Twitter. I couldn't go on Facebook. And do you know what? I managed to survive. I'll tell you what I did. Now, this will date me a bit. It makes me seem a bit old-fashioned. You know what I did? I picked up a book and read.
Wow.
Now, I was completely unspoiled. Thing is, I'm sure I saw someone, people saying, oh, there's a Cyberman in this. And I must, because I'm sure I must have heard someone say, oh, the Cyberman will be linked to the whole Frankenstein thing. But at my age, my memory is so bad, I just forget things now.
I have to say, I was slightly concerned that they sort of took away a bit of Mary Shelley's agency by making her have the idea for Frankenstein after standing there chatting to a big Cyberman and hearing the Doctor talk about him.
Yeah.
But I guess, technically, time's been altered, hasn't it? So they've taken away her initial reason for writing that story, which was that they were all sat there one night in the drawing room and decided to have a ghost story competition, which is what actually happened. And obviously, because of the arrival of the Cyberium, all that's changed. So I guess, technically, they were just, it was just time putting itself back on track, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So that wasn't too bad. Can I ask, you know, when in the cold open, when there's a knock at the door and they all go to answer the door, not only are the people answering the door surprised that there's somebody at the door when the door's been knocked on, but the people knocking on the door are surprised when it's opened, but also they're French windows. They're glass.
Oh. Have they?
Oh.
You look at it, they're glass. But Ivan literally yanks open these two doors made of panes of glass and goes, oh my God. Honestly, rewatch it. It just doesn't make any sense at all. Just other than it's about as threatening a kind of cliffhanger as the Third Doctor walking along and spotting that there's a pattern on the floor.
Oh, yeah.
Stop right there.
Yes. I thought Lily Miller as Mary Shelley was excellent. I really enjoyed her performance. I thought she's great. Mm. I mean, I found most of the guest stars to be pretty good, actually. I enjoyed Fletcher, the valet, as well. When the Cyberman has him by the throat and is lifting him off the ground, and Fletcher still calls it Sir.
Yeah.
I liked how he just standing in the corner looking really cheesed off throughout.
Yeah, with those wonderful eye rolls. Yeah, he was great.
You're absolutely right about the Cyberman killing the maid, Hayden, and then picking up the child.
Yeah.
And interesting that we're not... I mean, they've got him as a Cyberman as a man, isn't he? I think, okay, I'm glad he's only half maid. He talks like a man, not a machine, and we can see some facial movement. And he's not presented as a tragic figure here, is he?
No.
He's actually a baddie. Oh, I slit my own children's throats.
Mm. Yeah, he's basically... He does seem like he's a genuine psychopath. It kind of reminds me a little bit of the original Frankenstein story, or is it... Is it in the book, or is it just in the... I think it might just be in the film. It's been a long time since I've read the book, but I know
in
the...
It's in the book.
In the films, Igor, who's not in the book, is he? But Igor in the films goes to collect a brain, and I think he picks up the wrong one, doesn't he? And he picks up the brain of a murderer as opposed to the brain of a scientist or something. So basically... The Frankenstein monster ends up with the brain of a psychopath, and this Cyberman's definitely a psychopath, isn't he?
What did we think of the whole one life versus many debate?
That whole scene I thought was brilliant. It was lovely to see a bit of that alienness and a bit of the Doctor showing that she's different to the human companions she takes round. You know, it's all very lovely, being very jolly and nice. You're my fam, and aren't we all having a lovely time? And I think, actually, it was nice to see her admit that all that stuff about it's a very flat team structure.
That was good. That was good.
It's actually a mountain.
Yeah, I thought those were excellent lines, and I thought they were delivered beautifully. But the actual... Sorry, what was the initial question, Doc?
You can't kill Shelley to save billions of people. Mm.
No, I thought that was... I don't know.
I mean, I can't say Shelley's writings have... they've not changed the world that much, I don't think. Important writer, but not to the extent that... what a loss.
Well, how do you know, though? It still has influenced thousands of people throughout the centuries. And she does say, you know, one death, one ripple could completely change future history. Although, having said that, I'm sure there's been other times. It's funny, isn't it, how the Doctor sometimes is very much like, you can't rewrite history, not one bit.
Yeah.
You can't afford to cause one single ripple. And then other times she's just blundering through and changing. Well, that's all she does, is change history / future history. Because otherwise she'd have absolutely no agency whatsoever.
Well, she always seems to know which parts she can change and which parts she can't, though, doesn't she?
Maybe it's an instinctive thing, I don't know. But it seems a bit inconsistent, doesn't it? But it's always been that way anyway.
Yeah.
So I guess that's not new. I liked the line, save the poet, save the universe. But did that remind anyone else of Heroes?
Save the cheerleader.
Yes.
Mm. Yeah.
Was it save the cheerleader, save the
world. Yeah.
Save the podcaster, save the world.
That could be our new slogan.
Sort the podcaster, save the universe.
But do we think it's possible? I'm quite looking forward to the next two, I must say. But I think it's entirely possible that we haven't yet seen what it is that Cyberman really wants.
Yeah.
You know, the Doctor's not supposed to give him.
Yes, I'm not sure either. I mean, the whole thing with the Cyberium, sorry, slightly backtracking, I wasn't sure why the Cyberium was hiding itself from the Cyberman.
No. I mean, there's a suggestion that it was this thing that this alliance sent across Spain.
Sent across Spain.
To save them. And then there's this other suggestion that does it belong to the Cybermen? Or does it belong to someone else and the Cybermen are trying to steal it?
Well, it's called the Cyberium. It's got all their entire history and stuff in it. You think it's something to do with the... Oh, I don't know. Oh, yeah, maybe the Cyberium is just what Jack and his people called it when they... Did they steal it? Can you remember if Jack said he... He just said they sent it back through time and space, didn't they?
I think he did, yeah. I think he was just saying...
So we don't know where it came from exactly, do we? We don't know if it was stolen or whether they'd created it.
Jack says in Fugitive of the Dajun, an empire of evil in ruins right now, brought down to nothing finally, but that could all change if she doesn't listen to this message. To defeat them, which is presumably the Cybermen, the Alliance sent this thing back through time across space, and then he turns into Kermit.
The only way that makes sense if it's something that they've taken from the Cybermen, isn't it? If it's to defeat them. There's no point them making something that's got all this information on it and then sending it back to a lake in 1816, is it?
No.
It's slightly bizarre, isn't it?
Because I can't see how that would defeat them. So you'd think it was something that Cybermen... I don't know. Again, these are the sort of questions that I'm not sure necessarily pop up on the first watch. It's usually during the second watch that I find things like this a bit... To be honest, I kind of needed to rewatch this one after rewatching Can You Hear Me, because I needed a bit of fun. I was very down after my second watch of Can You Hear Me, and I have to say, watching The Haunting.
I was more down because I didn't like it.
Yes, different
reasons. I think you had a more personal reason.
Yeah, I felt slightly traumatised the second time around. But watching Haunting of Villa Diodati was quite a pleasant bit of light relief, really, even with all the horror stuff in it. I did wonder at one point if it wasn't going to turn into Hardware. You know, the film where, I think we mentioned it before, that was ripped off of 2000 AD.
Oh, stolen from 2000 AD, yes.
Where there's a soldier who's they have parts of. When Shelley was saying he's got this skeleton, I wondered if it was going to be... this Cyberman was going to rebuild itself from spare parts around the house.
So nice bits here and there. And the second half was far better than the first. But because I think the second half, not only the Cyberman became interesting, but the Cyberman took the story by the scruff of the neck and dominated it. But I'm still having problems just getting past this TARDIS team. Fighting was so irritating. And if Tussin Kaur's going off to join a series in America, good luck to him.
I reckon you're probably experiencing that because they're coming towards the end of their run. You know, I don't think anyone believes that they're going to be in it in the third series as that TARDIS team. And it's kind of like the same, like when I do my races, the hardest kilometre isn't the first, it isn't the last. It's about the eighth or ninth out of the ten. Because the finishing line is in sight. You know, you're almost there, but you're still such a distance away. So that's possibly, in a way, how you're feeling with the show, perhaps, or with that TARDIS team.
Tosin and Mandip were all right in this episode. I quite enjoyed their performance.
I thought they were.
I thought this was one of their better episodes. Although I do have to say that they're still put in the shade by Bradley Walsh, whose delivery of certain lines...
Even now he's descended to a comedy cockney, he's still... axed the three of them off the screen, I think.
Yeah, it's great. But no, I disagree. I thought they were right in this episode. I thought definitely one of the better stories in the season as well. And again, I don't think, is it a coincidence that this one doesn't seem to have necessarily a massive sort of theme and message, does it?
Yeah. No, it doesn't. No,
that's true.
No, certainly not in the obvious way that half the season has had so far. So, you know, this along with Fugitives of the Jadoo and for me the Nikola Tesla one, basically my three favourites so far.
I've run out of things to say, I must admit.
Yeah, I think I'm done. Just thoroughly enjoyed it, and I'm looking forward to the final two-parter now.
I did wonder if the Doctor having the Siberian, even though it was only very briefly, I wonder if that's going to be something, you know, because she must have learnt something from it in that time.
Possibly.
So I wonder if that will come back in the next couple of episodes.
Marks out of 10, I will give it 6.5.
Ooh. I would give it 8.5.
I'm going to give it a 9.
Well.
My second highest score, I think.
If the second half hadn't happened, I'd probably give it a 3.
Wow.
Yeah, you're really over this series, aren't you? Completely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bring on the Eccleston retrospective. It'll be like a pig in shit.
I have to say, that is how I felt about Series 1 with Eccleston after I'd watched Series 11. It was so... Series 11 finished last year, and I just... I really didn't enjoy it at all and got quite grumpy about it towards the end.
Yeah, same here.
And when I went back to rewatch Series 1 with Christopher Eccleston, it was just like, oh, such a soothing balm to my soul. It was lovely.
It wasn't just the series, it was the whole thing that surrounded it. It seemed to be a happiness in the whole country, obviously. That Doctor Who was back. There were no podcasts in that day. There's no Twitter. There's no Facebook. It's only about a week before Rose went out that I went online for the first time at home. And I'd only just discovered Outpost Gallifrey, and was slack-jawed in disbelief.
There were more innocent times.
Yeah, there were.
With more goodwill towards the series, because...
And you can't call me, and I won't accept being called a hater, despite hating it, because it doesn't disturb me in the least that you two thought the opposite of these episodes. In fact, it cheers me up a bit.
Yeah. Well, that's why I'm here.
Oh, what's this? It's the Sons of Scarrow Daleks approaching us.
Emergency regulations. Please do not dump bodies into the river.
Dalek Ray. We have mechanoid ships in Sector 27.
It's a trap!
Right, we've just received a message from the Ovaltine lawyers. They seem to be quite upset that we've associated soothing voices with Horlicks. And they're asking for equal treatment.
Oh, okay.
All right. Shall we? So we want to keep the peace, don't we? Shall we sign out singing the Ovaltine's theme song?
Right. Okay.
Right. Have a gargle with Ovaltine. Practice your received pronunciation O's. O.
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 Ew. Ew.
Okay, so we'll say goodbye, listeners, and then we'll sing you out with the Ovaltini's song.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Get your Eccleston votes
bye.
In.
Goodbye.
Till next time.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Because
could be seen. Because we all drink Ovaltine, we're happy girls and boys.
You have been listening to the Diddly Dum Podcast. Find us on our blog at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com, on iTunes, Facebook, Audioboo, and Stitcher.com at diddlydum, on Twitter at diddly_dum, or email us at diddlydumpodcast@yahoo.co.uk. Diddly Dum. It is liquid podcasting, fitted in your ear.